Good morning. It's great to see everyone today and reiterate what Danny said. Really appreciate on these particular weekends. We have a lot of our members visiting other places and many of you visiting here. It's very special for us to have you in our midst and to get to know you. We are studying through 1 Peter, and we're in 1 Peter chapter 4 this morning. We're going to look at verses 1 through 6. And this is an interesting text, and I just ask you this question. When you think of suffering for righteousness' sake, as Peter has talked about throughout his letter, what is usually, we think of, the reason for the suffering? In other words, what generally happens that someone is going to say something evil about you or is going to maybe get in your face about something or question you? It is usually something that has to do with what we're teaching. We are going to try to share the gospel with folks, and a lot of times that results in some kind of pushback or reviling, as Peter has talked about, or mocking. Those things happen. But interestingly enough, Peter introduces in this section another reason for suffering for righteousness' sake. And it is a surprising reason. It is a reason that we are dealing with very, very strongly today. And when you think about it, we've always dealt with it to some degree, but it is really ramping up now. And the reason is we are often suffering now for righteousness' sake because we refuse to sin. And that is an interesting thought. I'd like you to see that this morning as what is actually happening in the first century and is also now happening as well today. So first off, I want you to just give a quick picture here of connecting the text. He started back in chapter 3 and verse 14 and said, even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, and he gives the point of suffering for righteousness' sake, and then he turns and gives the example of Jesus connecting chapter 13, 3 verse 18 to chapter 4 verse 1, 3:18, for Christ also suffered, and then 4:1 our text, since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, he makes that connection. He goes from there and shows how Christ suffered. He suffered because he wanted to bring people to God, and he illustrates that in Jesus through the Spirit, preaching in the days of Noah to those who were now dead. He follows up by saying that Jesus brought that salvation to Noah in spite of an overwhelming rejection of the teaching. In fact, the entire world of Noah's day rejected, with the exception, of course, of just 8 souls. And yet, he goes on to say that even though only 8 were saved, he saved them the same way that he saves us today. He saved them through water, and that brought them to the salvation, and he's telling these Christians, you were saved the same way through the water of baptism and the resurrection, the power being the resurrection of Christ. And then finally, he says, though you were few, you too will be saved. He compares them to the 8 who were saved in the flood, and now these Christians now who are also few, but not as few as they were, but even though you're few, you also will be saved. And then chapter 4, verse 1 turns and says, since Christ suffered in the flesh, no longer live for human passions. You also need to do as Christ did and cease from sin and accept the suffering that comes from not participating in sin around us. So this is his final reason of why people suffer for righteousness' sake. And that really connects quite well for us today. Now, let's notice this phrase, and this is what keys everything in the text. Arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. the same way of thinking as Jesus did when he ceased. He, of course, never sinned, but he intended to save souls by not sinning, living a perfect life, and we then are to cease from sin so that we also can bring that same picture. Now, let's begin with this. Righteousness is the top priority. We are suffering for righteousness' sake. Righteousness is the top priority. In other words, it doesn't matter what the threat is, what the ill treatment might be, what the consequences of our refusal to in support sinful things. It does not matter. We are not going to compromise righteousness. That's our top priority. We can never teach a lost world if we compromise on righteousness. We can never stand correctly with Christ if we compromise on righteousness. Christians are to be champions of righteousness. That's so critical. If we do not stand out as a light to the world, then our whole mission and our whole cause and our whole purpose has been for nothing, and we stand wrong in God's sight. This is what we champion. We're going to champion righteousness. Now, someone might ask, and I did this as I was studying this, why in the world, when anyone want to persecute me or persecute you or cause you to suffer simply because you decided not to do what they're doing? That doesn't make sense. In a world in which we live in freedom, freedom, yay, freedom, you get to do what you want to do and I get to do what I want to do, why in the world would I suffer because I don't want to do what you want to do? And Peter answers that question. He does it he gives two answers, both in the same verse, in verse 4. He says this, when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, they malign you. If you do not join them, they malign you. What an interesting statement. If you join them, everything will be fine. If you'll join them and practice the sin they practice, then it'll be all right. What really is happening? Your lack of desire to join them is a message of condemnation to them. They're figuring something out. Why won't you join us? And that brings the second reason. They're surprised, or I really do like the King James, New King James translation there, American Standard Version. They think it's strange. They think it's strange that you will not join them in this same activity. That's weird. And they're shocked at you. Now, you might ask the question, well, why would the people of the first century here in this area where these Christians have been exiled, why would that be a shock and surprise to them? Well, it's a little bit more even than today, but not too much. To practice the sins they were practicing was very often in honor of the Caesar and the Roman Empire. It was an offer to the gods of the empire. Because the gods of the empire were the ones who gave Rome, in their view, of course, gave Rome their power and gave Rome their ability to be the great nation and the great empire they were. And you would not honor the gods who have brought us to this particular place? This was anathema. They're shocked, they're surprised that you will not join them in the same partying to rejoice in what Rome had given to them. And of course, since they think it's strange and they're surprised, that leads to confrontation and questions about why you won't. That was noted for us already in chapter 3 and verse 15, when Peter said, you need to be ready to give an answer when you're suffering. You need to be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in you. And so this then brings that up when they confront you as to why you're not participating in these things, and you give a faith answer, boom. Now we've got a serious confrontation going on. Paul said in Ephesians 5, verse 11 and 12, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them, for it is shameful even to speak of the things they do in secret. Yes, in a confrontation where we have to defend our faith, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is we are going to expose what's wrong, not in a mean way, not in a cantankerous way or contentious way. We're simply going to present what is actually wrong here. And by not joining them, and by the fact that you're not joining them is strange and surprising to them, it then leads to suffering for righteousness' sake. Are you feeling right now that was just the first century? I want to tell you, that is not the first century alone. That's today. The month of June, many of you probably know this, was Pride Month. I thought it interesting that we have D-Day and Veterans Day and Memorial Day and Labor Day and Independence Day, but we have a whole month that has been designated to celebrate a group and an organization that is pushing, promoting, even in some areas and in some schools, as low as kindergarten area, pushing this kind of sexuality. And this is going to go on for a whole month. And if you think that it doesn't affect us and we just go, okay, well, you guys do your thing and we're going to do our thing, that's not correct. They're not letting us do our thing anymore. Because woe is you if you do not join in celebrating with them. We have two members of our congregation whose jobs have been threatened in this past month. Of our congregation, two members, their jobs were threatened in this past month. Because they respectfully, gently said, I can't participate in that. I was quite encouraged by the Tampa Bay Rays, the baseball team in Tampa. They walked into their locker room at the beginning of June, and they had uniforms and hats that celebrated Pride. And there was a whole number of them that respectfully would not do it, and wrote a nice letter. If you could look it up and read it, they wrote a wonderful, gentle letter. We hate no one. We despise no one. We're afraid of no one. That's not the issue. We're simply following our faith, and we do not want to violate our faith. The team owner and organization was surprised. Very good. You need to be surprised. They were surprised because they stood. This is the reason I have been preaching through 1 Peter. It isn't because it might be something that's happening or would happen. It is something that is happening. And I'm persuaded it will get worse and worse. Jobs have been lost by many in upper echelons of government and other areas and corporations simply because they would not join in the celebration. It's gone far past. There's already laws on equality on this thing. It's always laws that you can't discriminate. We're all in favor of that. But you have to celebrate it. You have to promote it. And if you don't join with them, then you're going to be acknowledged as someone who is a hater, someone who despises, somebody who's strange and weird, and what you stand for is terrible. We need to prepare ourselves, and this is why 1 Peter is here. This brings up a principle here of how would we answer these things? How do we answer? I don't want to just leave it like that and say, okay, isn't woe is us, isn't that terrible? Because woe isn't us. This is an opportunity to teach the gospel. And that's the reason God puts us in these situations. It's an opportunity to preach the gospel and teach the gospel, not an opportunity to go around and bellyache about it and point our finger. That's not the point. That's not what Peter teaches. Peter's teaching opportunity here. So think of a few things here. When you look at this particular text, I want you to notice, first off, that they are surprised when you do not join them. Now, that idea of being surprised should tell us something. They think it's strange and surprised. So then put yourself in their shoes. If you're in their shoes, why would you think that preaching what Jesus taught and Jesus' principles are shocking? Well, you would think that because you have absolutely no idea about the teachings of God and the teachings of Jesus. And whatever teachings that you have heard are that Jesus loves everybody and therefore everything people do is fine with Jesus. That would be the conclusion. That's where they are. So how would you approach something like that? We have to approach it, obviously, with respect and gentleness. As Peter said in chapter 3 and verse 15, respect and gentleness is the approach to understand that they simply do not understand what's going on here. Recognize here, too, that what happens in this is sin gets renamed. Just like on the issue of abortion. Abortion's a nice term. Or where the people hold cards up and march in the streets, my body. I want to hold a card up and say, baby's body. Baby's body too. So what's going on here? Satan loves to rename things. In the garden, Satan said to Eve, God just doesn't want you to become like him. That's the real issue here. That's not the real issue, Satan. He loves to change the issue in some kind of way. In chapter 5 and verse 20 of Isaiah, Isaiah said the people call good evil and evil good. They rename things. And this is quite common. Pride. Let's have a pride parade. What are we doing? What's Satan doing there? He's renaming what we ought to be proud about. I see bumper stickers all the time. I'm proud of my fourth grader for graduating whatever or did whatever or something like this. But now I see people, I'm proud of my son or daughter who has now transed to a different choice of gender as if there is any choice. That is pride in what? Pride in a sexuality and a sexual choice that is damaging, that there is a suicide rate of around 15% of kids who do this. It's devastating, and it's a lifestyle that the Lord has condemned because the Lord cares and loves and does not want people to be hurt and damaged. It's not pride in right things. It's pride in wrong things. And there's another thing to understand here when we're talking to someone. No one lives without lines or rules. Please remember that. When you're having a discussion with someone, understand they have lines and rules as well. So I would suggest a tactical three-question approach in the same vein as we studied a couple of weeks ago from Greg Kokel's work. On tactical questions. In other words, I'm having a conversation with someone who is attacking me because I won't promote a pride parade, for example. Here would be a question. Do you believe it acceptable to hate a person because of their personal decisions about gender or sexual choices? Do you think it's okay to hate somebody that way about that? I would suggest they would say absolutely. No, you cannot hate somebody who for their choices of those things. I totally agree with you. You cannot hate people because of their choices, even if I think it's a sinful choice. I am not allowed to hate anyone. I want to love them even more. Well, okay, good. We're in agreement on that. Do you believe that there are some lines, rules, or laws that ought to be drawn concerning some sexual practices, for example, child abuse? Would you agree with that? Oh, most people, except the child abuser, now most people would say, oh yes, I don't think we should allow that. We should draw the line there. So good, we are in agreement on there are lines that should be drawn on sexuality. Good. Third question. Would you join a group that wanted to promote adult-child relationships with parades? Would you promote it? Oh, well, no, that would not be right. Good. You and I have agreed on two main principles here. We've agreed that we each have lines and rules that we believe people should abide by because it's good for our society, it's good for all culture, if not thinking about the foundation for those rules. We at least agree on that. We also agree that we should not hate or abuse anybody who disagrees with us. Is that good? Great. Then I think we should also understand that our primary disagreement is simply where those lines ought to be drawn. I'm going to draw those lines based on the lines Jesus drew. You're going to draw your lines based on some other reason. You may try to persuade me, and that's fine. I would love to listen to your point of view. I will try to persuade you concerning the lines Jesus drew, if you would like. But one thing we will always come to is that we're not going to hate each other. We're not going to abuse each other. We're not going to hurt each other simply because you have one belief and I have another. Because we both agree there ought to be some lines drawn in places. We just need to discuss the lines. That would be my tactical approach to this. A gentle approach that would keep a person from saying, you're strange. No, you have the same beliefs I do. Don't hate. Have some line somewhere. And recognize that it's important not to hate and abuse anybody. Very good. Let's go from there. So that would be one of, I think, the best ways to answer this. We always must remember where they're coming from in that. So the final thing let's look at what the Lord says about this concerning the text and us no longer living for human passions, but for the will of God. I do want you just to notice that word thinking in the text in verse 1. Arm yourselves the same way of thinking. In the Greek, the word can also be translated resolve. In other words, it's not just how you think, but it's the same resolve. It's a resolve to live righteously and to cease from sin. And he says, whoever, notice this text, whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. What's the relationship there? If you're suffering for righteousness' sakes, it means you've ceased from sin. What it means is your resolve to not live in sin is so strong that the result is going to be you're going to suffer when somebody reviles you for not joining in with them and begins to malign you. Nobody's going to malign you if you don't have a resolve to cease from sin. And so there is his main thing. A good gauge of this is do the people around you find you surprising when you do not participate in these things? Or maybe even a better gauge is, do you yourself feel strange when you're in the presence of sinful practices? Do you feel strange? If not, your conscience may have been hardened, calloused, and you're not as separate from sin that you ought to be. And then he says, they malign you. Let's look at another reason why they malign you. Do you realize in the first century it was perfectly okay to be a follower of Christ if You did not see being a follower of Christ as exclusive to all other gods and all other ways of believing and all other patterns or rules of morality. You can be a follower of Christ. Just accept the other gods as well. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed today. You can call yourself a Christian. In fact, there are oodles of denominations and churches that accept Pride Month and accept those things, and they're not persecuted. They're not reviled. They're rejoiced because they have joined. And that's the key word. The question is, you are reviled if you won't join. To see Christianity as exclusive, and that has always been the case. It is not just today. It's not just in the first century. It has always been the case that if Christ is exclusive in your life, if He is the only God, if He is the only one you're going to follow, and if His ways are the only ways and only laws that you will follow and place preeminent in your life, that is when persecution happens. Every time. That's always when it happens. And that's what we need to understand as well. No longer living, he says, I want you to notice the words, human passions. Here's an important point, too, in discussion with people. First off, all humans have passions that are contrary to Jesus. That needs to be promoted. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 says, there is no temptation that has taken you that is not common to all men. Every temptation is common to all men, which clearly means there is no way that I can say, well, I was just born different than the rest of you, or what I want to do in my life is just unique. I'm a unicorn, you know. I'm just different than everybody, and you must accept how different I am because I have unique fleshly desires. Don't condemn me for who I am. Hold on. You're not a unicorn. There's no such thing. You suffer the passions of the flesh just like I do, and every person who's ever taken a breath of air. These passions are common to all men, and you have placed yourself and lifted yourself up as if you are unique above all other humans because your certain passion somehow is different. It isn't different. Everybody has passions contrary, this is the key, contrary to the teachings of Christ. Every person does. Which means what? Which means Peter has called us to stop it, to deny it, to rid ourselves of it, to no longer live. Do you notice the words in verse 3? The words are sensuality, passions, etc. But those first two words say it all. Sensuality is the... I grew up with the King James Version, and it said it quite well. Lasciviousness. Translators quit translating that because that way, because nobody knew what that meant. So they've tried sensuality. But the word means the same. It just means to let loose of any inhibitions against passions of the flesh. That's all it means. You can name whatever you want to. That is a fulfillment of the passion of the flesh that is against the laws of Christ. And he says that's sensuality. You have to control your passion. You see, everybody has them. Everybody has passions, not just you. Yours aren't unique above anybody else's. Everyone has passions that are against the teachings of Jesus. And we must, he's called us to no longer live that way. I love the way Peter says, verse 3, for the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do. In other words, you've filled enough time in that business to find out that it is a losing proposition. If you want to live for Christ, if you want the salvation that the eight souls had in the days of Noah, you will deny yourself the passions that are against the teachings of Christ. It isn't our identity. That's another way that Satan has renamed this. It's not a choice anymore. You're born that way. Not a choice anymore. This is who I am and this is who I've decided to be. Not a choice anymore. It's what they are. Excuse me. It's what I am too. And I have to deny it. He's called us to do that. No one's unique in that. He's not asking you to do anything different than what everybody has to do. We all have to deny the passions of the flesh that are against Christ. He concludes the text with two verses here, in verses 5 and 6, that are great encouragement to all of us. This is why I want to end on this right here. You see the words he says concerning those who are surprised and they malign you. Verse 5, he begins with, but. But they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is why the gospel was preached even to those who are dead, that though judged in the flesh the way people are, they might live in the spirit the way God does. That last verse is a little tough the way it's rendered, and we want to make some sense of it. But first, let's just notice. He says, but remember, when they malign you, number one, they will give an account. They will give an account for maligning you. They will give an account for their flood of debauchery. They will give an account for their sensuality and their passions and their drunkenness and their orgies and their drinking parties. They will give an account for those things. So remember, when they malign you, do not lose heart, because they will give an account. And to whom will they give an account? They will give an account to the judge who's ready to judge the living and the dead. He's ready to judge. They will give an account. You don't want to be one who has joined them and have to give an account, to stand before God on that day and give an account. Can you imagine yourself right now? Imagine yourself standing before God on that day and having to give an account. That's the end result. That's the end test. That's where we need to be really prepared. And his judgment is universal. No one's accepted. Well, he's not going to judge the dead. Yeah, he's going to judge the living and the dead. Which, last time I checked, that's pretty well everybody. He's going to judge the living and the dead. We need to understand that judgment is coming, and that's why we do this. Look at this verse 6 so you understand a little better from the translation. It'll be helpful to getting the meaning of the text. He says, now it was for this very purpose. All right, remember, for what purpose? The purpose that he's ready to judge the living and the dead. It is for this very purpose that the gospel was preached to those who are now dead, so that though they were judged in the flesh by human standards, they may live spiritually by God's standards. Okay, in other words, just to highlight what he's saying here, the preaching that was done is done to, and he's when he refers to the dead, he's referring to those who are already dead. They weren't dead when they were preached to. But why did you preach to them? Because of this judgment. Now they are dead, but they are those who have gotten their reward. They were judged in the flesh by human standards. They were maligned. But now they're living spiritually by God's standards. God's justified them. So why should you not be concerned and get overly upset when someone maligns you for not joining them? You don't do that, because that's the reason we preach. To save people from being judged by God, and instead them having to suffer a malignment announced. So the bottom line is, when you are in those strange situations, when you're in those situations where they're surprised that you do not join them and that you refuse to support those kinds of activities, think of how God judges you. You may be maligned and judged by human standards now, but the result will be you will live spiritually by God's standards. God will justify in that day. All right, I hope that helps. And reminding us that this is a wonderful challenge because it gives us an opportunity. We don't want to shy from the opportunity. We don't want to be afraid of it. We want to be prepared for it. And we want to act like the people of God and gently and respectfully always speak to those that we deeply love and want to go to heaven. That's the proper approach. If you're not a Christian, if there's any way we can help you this morning, you can talk to us afterwards or in any other way if there's something we can do for you. Right now, we're going to sing a song, and if you'd like to step forward, you can do so, and we'd be glad to help you while we stand and sing.